That's the stuff that makes it more meaningful. And yes, we can make a good return. You know, I really believe you can do well by doing good. And when I say do well, I mean financially. Yes, you can make a great living, but you can also do good as well and have an impact in people's lives.
Hey guys, welcome to the CRE Project Podcast. Guys, what's going on? Clayton King here. You know, today's show is just crazy. We have an exceptional guest on with us today that has built a company that now currently owns and manages over $1.3 billion worth of commercial real estate throughout America. We welcome Brian Watson. Brian is the founder and CEO of North Star Commercial Partners, which is based out of Denver, Colorado, and also has an office in New York City. He began his journey in commercial real estate with Cushman & Wakefield and soon earned his stripes there, earning accolades of being the youngest broker to reach the director status within Cushman & Wakefield, which is definitely no easy feat. And then after 7 years of working at Cushman & Wakefield, he launched North Star Commercial Partners in the year 2000. So they are turning 20 on the year 2020, which is pretty cool. We talked about that a little bit in the podcast. But, you know, North Star is a multifaceted and vertically integrated real estate company. And they specialize in acquiring value add real estate. You know, one thing that's interesting about Brian, which you'll hear in the podcast, is he kind of approaches real estate not only from an economic perspective, but one of the most important aspects to him and his team is the social aspect behind a lot of his acquisitions that he makes. So just a really exceptional individual that's just built a tremendous company, and we learned a ton. So sit back, relax, buckle up. You're about to learn a lot. Brian, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
On the CRE Project Podcast. Very excited to have you on the show. So we've given our listeners a very extensive background on who you are and what you've accomplished. But to start out, we'd obviously like to hear that from you. Like to hear kind of your background, how you got into the commercial real estate business, and how you kind of eventually ended up to where you're at today.
Great. Well, again, thank you for having me on your show. I'm honored and humbled by it. So I grew up in very humble beginnings, you know, on the western slope of Colorado, small agricultural community, and had a family that was involved in real estate, mainly from the construction side. So when I was young, my dad would do fix-up projects in a home or whatever, and so I was in charge of helping him to, you know, lay brick, to you know, knock down walls or whatever it might be. And always wanted to be involved in real estate. So I went and got a degree from CU Boulder in commercial real estate. Then I was a broker for 7 years with Cushman & Wakefield.
Right.
And I can't say enough positive things about the brokerage industry, and I know you guys are involved with that as well. And it's just a phenomenal training ground on so many different levels. But I always wanted to have my own company. So after 7 years of doing that, I founded North Star Commercial Partners. And here we are turning 20 in the year 2020. So
that's
it's
fantastic.
Been a wonderful
Absolutely.
Ride.
So in your book, you reference, obviously, the stronger the foundation, the higher the tower. Who do you feel like was your foundation?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, I would probably say definitely my parents. I know people, a lot of people say that, but my parents were entrepreneurs. And through blood, sweat, and tears, they sacrificed, they put it all on the line for our family. And my mother, my father passed, but my mother is still alive to this day. And I talked to her this morning as a dutiful son. I gave my mom a call. So she's listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
I took care of mom. But, you know, it's just that tenacity of work ethic and having a positive mindset for the future, but also not to define oneself by what you have. And I think that's really important. My parents were very humble, kind, and giving people. and my mom still is to this day. And it wasn't whether what kind of car you were driving or what kind of house that you lived in. It was more of what can you give back to society? And that really resonated with me and kind of makes you a little bit invincible, because whether you have much or whether you have little, depending on where you are in life, what really matters is your integrity and are you loving and serving other people?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, I really enjoyed the part in your book where you said that you really wanted to test yourself and see what you were made of.
Yeah.
Which I think is just such a strong attribute to have as an individual, and you really need it in the commercial real estate space.
Yeah.
So obviously you pivoted and went into the brokerage field, as you mentioned, with Cushman and Wakefield.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? What drew you to, you know, Cushman and Wakefield specifically, and the Denver market, because we knew that you spent some time up in New York.
Yeah.
What made you come back out west, and why that firm?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a funny story. So I graduated from CU Boulder, and I was going to go to the Peace Corps. And my eye was set on the Peace Corps and went back and worked at my father's residential real estate office. He had a Century 21 office about 2 hours outside of New York City in the Catskill Mountains. And I worked there and loved it during the summer. In the meantime, I was going to West Point and getting my inoculations, getting ready to go to the Peace Corps. I had an assignment in Africa. And then about a month before I was ready to leave, the Peace Corps said, "We found out when you were young, you were stung by yellow jackets and had a reaction, and we can't accept you."
Oh,
and I
said,
"What do you mean you can't accept me? I mean, that's my plan and my vision." So anyway, about that time, I went down to New York City and met a gentleman, and he was launching this revolutionary new idea where he was going to try to take all the availabilities and information on buildings and put it on an online database.
Look at that.
A la CoStar and everything that we take advantage of this day, right? So during that meeting, he said, "You know, I'd like to offer you a job." And I said, "Well, I'm very honored and humbled." And I said, "Thank you, but I'm going to go back to Colorado because that's where my heart is, out west." And so he said, "Well, you know what? You look like a Cushman & Wakefield guy anyway."
Huh.
And I didn't know if that was a compliment or a dig at the time, because I was this young college student.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went back back to Colorado, and I started interviewing with firms. And I came across this firm called Cushman & Wakefield and really liked what I saw there. And so I was just diligent. And as I say in my book, I finally offered that I'll come to work for free.
Sure.
And they finally felt sorry for me, I guess.
Persistence.
And gave me a job. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did you specialize in the brokerage field?
Yeah. So one thing I would say, whoever it is that might be listening, you know, if you're thinking about a career path, I can't say enough positive things about brokerage.
Yeah,
I absolutely love it. And it's one of those industries that it's about persistence and tenacity. It's about dealing with this word called no and how do you address it. And also just being rewarded for your creativity and your hard work. And I don't know of many industries where with a matter of a phone call or a meeting or a link, you can change your financial stars so dramatically and you can have such amazing impact. At the same time, you can put in a whole lot of hours and not get paid a dime,
yep,
you know, for another transaction. And so the commercial brokerage industry taught me some valuable lessons about, you know, persistence and tenacity. My training program at the time, we had a manager and we had hard phone lines, and there was this Contacts Influential, which was this big, thick book of all the deal. And it said, start dialing. And you would just start dialing for dollars.
Yeah.
And it was just a really powerful, powerful thing. And one of the things I remember to this day, I try to always have goals. And he gave us a picture of I-25. And for those that are familiar with Denver and I-25, where it meets I-70, we call it the mouse trap here in Denver. And he said, you know, we're trying to hit our goal up here, but you're going to hit these mouse traps of life where there's all these different on and off ramps and traffic congestion, but focus on your goal. And that really crystallized with me. And even to this day, like, my team can know about me that once we have a goal, we're going to get there.
Yeah.
And we have to go through the gauntlet. And so brokerage just teaches you about, you know, the speed of a transaction, understanding how to build relationships with people in a very short time period, and being creative throughout that process.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more on all the above.
I love it. It's a tough industry, and it's a hyper-competitive industry.
It really
I mean,
is.
It is the best of the best.
Yeah.
In Colorado, for instance, the statistic is there's about 30,000 residential agents. Plus or minus, that probably has changed over the years. And there's about 800 commercial real estate agents.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of that, the old 90-10 rule or 80-20 rule, I would submit in Colorado is probably the 95-5 rule. 5% of the brokers are doing probably 95% of the transactions.
Yeah.
And so when you can compete at that level, it's extremely rewarding, but it's tough.
Yeah.
And it can take years to establish those relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah. Years. And your integrity and your mindset are just absolutely vital to that next transaction.
Yeah.
It's a game of stamina.
It is.
For sure. And persistence, which is what I... So what do you personally look for in a broker today as a principal in transactions?
Well, for me, I mean, the platforms matter, you know, in terms of it's an office. But, you know, we own assets now in 15 states throughout America. Mm. And we'll use brokerage shops that might consist of one person who's, you know, hung their name on the front door to the largest, you know, international companies that are out there. For me, what I care most about are things like the non-negotiables, even when I'm hiring, whether it be an employee or a broker. It's things like integrity and honesty, things like fire in the belly.
Mm-hmm.
And are you just sitting there and waiting for the phone to ring, or are you picking up that phone and going and making it? And I always tell brokers, they can make a single, a double, or a triple with us. You bring us a deal and we buy it, you can get to first base and get a commission. Mm-hmm. And if you want to lease it up and have the ability to lease up an asset for us, because we mainly buy vacant distressed assets, you can round second and get a nice commission on the lease up. And then you can come into third and slide into home and sell it for us. But I ask one thing during that whole process, is that you're adding value to the transaction. If all you're doing is having your hand out and expecting a commission or expecting this and not adding value to the equation, then that's where we're going to have a problem. And so we've been doing deals with brokers for a very long time. Some of our brokers we literally have been working with for 20 plus years. And, you know, they understand how to add value. The other thing about North Star, we're never a commission away. You know, a lot of landlords take brokers for granted. Mm-hmm. And even when you go to a closing table, you think about what an attorney gets paid on a settlement statement, and they get paid well. You think about what the title company gets paid, and then you look at this thing called brokerage commission. And it's this really big number oftentimes. And a lot of people say, oh, those brokers, they get paid too much, or oh, those brokers, whatever. But they forget that no one would be at that table unless a broker had been involved in creating the opportunity and the value. Yeah. And they also forget that brokers don't always get paid. You know, there's many transactions they don't get paid. And so for me, it's this idea of, are you adding value? Are you looking at it from our perspective as well? And are you long-term in our thinking? And one of the things I love about our business is that because you're dealing with big numbers, people can take advantage of you if they want to, right? And I actually, it hurt me at first when I was a broker, but now I love it because I can see somebody's true color. Are you going to be someone who's going to be a person of integrity, or are you just going to go for the dollars?
Yeah,
and if you're just going to go for the dollars, yeah, we'll have one transaction together, but we're not going to have transactions for decades to come.
Correct.
Right.
It's all about relationships in our business.
Yeah, really, we're always looking at the big picture, the long-term picture.
Yeah.
So moving from brokerage, you know, one thing that we really admire about you and your past is the fact that, you know, you grew from a broker to a developer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see a lot of people, and we're kind of stuck in that position right now where you want to take that next step. And reading your book, one of the most interesting parts to me was when you decided you were going to go out and start, you know, North Star Commercial Partners.
Yeah.
You basically said, you know, you went up to your wife and said, you know, I'm going to give it a try for a year, you know, and I think that's real admirable. And I would love to hear kind of what was going on in your mindset at that time. And more importantly, I would like to know, was that the right decision to make? Because we see a lot of brokers, you know, kind of dabble doing brokerage, doing development, kind of stay afloat with some cash through commissions, you know, so you got to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you kind of cutting it off cold turkey and saying, this is what I'm doing now, and allowing all your brain power to go towards building this company, you know, that just had to be ridiculously scary.
A little bit, especially with, you know, children and all the other wonderful things.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
You know, for me, again, there's many things that I love about brokerage, and I love brokers to this day, and I love their mindset and who they are as people. At the same time, on a personal level, what I didn't like about brokerage is that every January 1st, your income for the year was zero. Mm-hmm. Until you went out and you hunt and you kill and you can bring home food. And yes, you have your relationships. Yes, you have all these different deals. But really, you got to go out and make it happen.
Yeah.
And personally for me, I was interested in long-term wealth creation.
Yep.
That no matter where I was, no matter what I was doing, somehow, some way, multiple income streams were coming to me. And I can be fly fishing or hunting, or I can be at home with my family, or I could be at the office, but somehow income was coming to me.
Right.
And so that's why I started, you know, North Star Commercial Partners. And it was a struggle at the time, but that was the primary driver, was that wealth creation. The other thing is, when I was a broker, you know, at the time, we weren't allowed to invest in commercial real estate. So the very thing that we were working on every single day, the company didn't want any conflicts of interest. So you think about, these brokers were high income earners, very high tax rates with very little write-offs. They then took whatever money they got, they split it with the house, they split it with their team, then they gave half to the government, and then whatever they were left with, they would then put in the stock market or something that they really knew nothing about and weren't interacting with daily. And for me, I wanted my money where I could touch and feel it and be working on it and moving that needle every day. So as I said in my book, I went home to my wife and I said, we're going to take a step backward for hopefully a giant leap forward. And I'd saved up enough money to live for a year. And I said, worst comes to worst, I'll go down to Mexico. If, you know, North Star doesn't work out, I'll go to Mexico, have a drink, a lot of tequila, and then come back and I can go back in a brokerage. But tequila soothes the soul, I guess. But anyway, so started North Star Commercial Partners above Ted's Montana Grill in Larimer Square and set the vision. And so I was 100% in. And I said, you know what? The only failure for me is not trying.
There you go.
The thing for me is, I don't want to live my life saying I wish I would have or could have.
Right.
And so I said, let's just put it all on the line. And we were blessed and fortunate. And now here we are 20 years later.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things, like you said, alluding back to, you know, every broker starts every year and every month at zero until they can build up some cash flow, not necessarily passive income, but as passive as it can be, and build that legacy income. Can you tell us how you had structured one of your first deals if you weren't able to roll commission in on your transactions?
Great question.
Yeah.
So I didn't come from a family of money. You know, my family taught me about blessings and hard work in that order. And so, you know, when people say, oh, you know, you go out and you raise money for your first deal with friends and family, well, maybe friends, but I didn't have any family that would be able to invest on that level. So I had to fund North Star 100%, pick out the logo, get everything set up, whatever it might be. I landed my first deal, one of the largest transactions. I went into the Benjamin Moore Paint Company, and I'd driven by a nice little building here in lower downtown Denver. In fact, you can see it right from here, and there was a big sign on the top of the roof said Benjamin Moore Paint. And I wasn't very smart, I guess, at the time, so I pulled an O&E and wanted to see who owned it. Well, Benjamin Moore Paint owned it. And so I called him up, called up the CFO, and went back to Montvale, New Jersey, and met with 12 people on their side. And I was in my 20s. And I said, they just sold off to Berkshire Hathaway to Warren Buffett. And I said, I want to buy all your excess real estate coast to coast in America. They're like, really? I'm like, yeah, absolutely I do. And so they gave me this list of assets they didn't want and identified five. And I put them under contract. And the contract at the time was about $9.3 million. And where I grew up in a small town on the western slope of Colorado, whenever you go down a dirt road, there's often these dogs that would come out from the houses and bark at the car. Anybody who's been in a, you know, rural area, you've seen that before.
Sure.
Well, I was one of those dogs. The difference is I had caught the bumper of this car called Benjamin Moore Paint. And I either was going to be drug around the neighborhood or I had to close that deal.
Yeah.
And so the way I did it is I went to a gentleman who had been very successful, had kind of retired, and done something similar in commercial real estate.
Who knew you and trusted you?
No, I cold called him.
Okay, wow.
And again, pick up the phone. I didn't know. And so I said, I've got a good proposition for you. I want to bring this deal to you, and I'm going to give you 50% of my GP level interest.
Yeah.
And all I need you to do is put your name to it. Love it if you'd invest, and I'd love it if you bring in some of your investors. I'll do all the work. And he agreed to it. And so I worked my tail off on that portfolio, gave him 50% of the GP, and the investors got a nice 75% return on invested dollars. So we bought it for $9.3 million. We monetized it for $22 million over 18 months. We bought by the pound and monetized by the ounce across the country. And that got our wind in our sails. And then I had to do it on one or two other transactions. And after a while, people said, you know what, this is somebody that we can invest with directly. And so then I've done it ever since on a direct basis.
And there are just so many questions, you know, and I, you know, want to be respectful of your time, obviously, but, you know, the acquisition side of it and the capital raising,
yeah.
and how did you start working with international investors, and how did you build that investor base, and the CRM you're using, you know, and not that we need to cover all those in chronological order, but any of that that jumps out at you that you just, you know, how did you start working with investors and building that database?
Yeah. Well, there's so much, you know, and again, I love people and I love meeting from people. And even to this day, I'll fly around the world or around the country just to meet someone, not so much for their money, but for their golden nuggets of wisdom. And to me, wisdom surpasses money, and the idea that wisdom can always go with you. And when you get a moment to spend 5 or 10 minutes with some of these titans of industry or people who have been successful over here, I'm always thinking, how can I take what they've done and apply it to commercial real estate? Just in the last 2 weeks, I've driven my chief of staff a little bit crazy. I had two different random meetings in tech, and all of a sudden I came back. I'm like, you know what? We can apply this to North Star, and here's how we can do it. So stuff like that gets me excited. But to answer your question succinctly, yeah, you've got to be chief cook and bottle washer. And I say to, you know, brokers or people who want to be entrepreneurs, or even some of my staff, once in a while I'll have an employee say, you know what, I want to start my own company. And you know what, I wish them great success, but I tell them it's really, really hard, and you got to be very multidimensional and flexible. So I went out and met some people that I knew, and then from there kind of grew the database and started with smaller high net worth individuals to invest, and
sure.
then started getting billionaires, and now we have several of the world's wealthiest billionaires that invest with us, and then migrated to institutional investors. But I said to people, our first few deals were kind of those $1 to $5 million deals, because I wanted to build up a 3-ring binder of success stories that we could go out and build upon.
Right.
The Benjamin Moore deal was a little bit larger transaction, 5 assets in 5 different states. But little by little, and you keep going and going, and you keep trying to create value. But one of the things I would encourage people, whatever you're doing, whether you're starting a company or you have a new widget, whatever it might be, always keep the investor and or your customer first and foremost in mind. And the more that you do that, we put our investors at the front of the line. They get paid first, they get the return of their capital first, they get a preferential return first before we ever take a dime out of the deal. And we do that because the more that they're at the front of the line, the more that those longer term relationships will come back. And so every single deal that we do, even to this day, we offer to our investors. I never cherry pick a deal and only keep the best deals for me and give my investors the dregs, right?
So
that's
true,
not
alignment
fair.
Of interest.
True alignment.
Yeah.
Every single deal we do, the investors have an opportunity to participate in.
Yeah.
We have hundreds of investors, both domestically and internationally now, and I just think it's really important.
So thank you for that.
There's a lot of questions
Thank
you for
We're really interested because, again, we see this a lot of times on people struggling to scale, you know, and like you said in your book, you know, when you start a business, you're the receptionist,
you're everything,
you know, so, you know, Gannon and I were talking on the way up and we were thinking, you know, who was Brian's first hire aside from the receptionist? I mean, as you were growing your company, who did you feel is the key player that you would hire next to help grow your vision and get to your destination?
Yeah.
As you mentioned in your book, you know, building your bus, if you will. You know, how did you, to this day, from a cultural perspective within a company, how do you identify certain traits within a hire to fit within the culture of, you know, the company that you built?
Yeah. So I would encourage anybody, whether it be business or politics or just life in general, really ask yourself some tough questions and understand what your personal skill sets are. The problem is that the personality that's willing to go out and take this level of risk sometimes has an ego or believes they can do everything by themselves. And for me, I said, you know what, here's what I can do really, really well. Now, I have to do everything when I'm starting the company. But as you grow and as you have some income, hire in the things that are either you're deficient in, that somebody can do better, and be honest with yourself that other people can do stuff a whole lot better than you can, right? Or that are not the highest and best use of your skill set. So even to this day, you know, we've got about 40 people here at our office and several others around the country. Every single time I'm figuring out what can I do on a personal level to move the needle the furthest for my firm, and what do I need to hire out that I either shouldn't be doing or that people can do better than me. And you have to, you know, be humble enough to be able to do that. And I love surrounding myself with people that are much more intelligent and capable than me in specific areas. My goal is to help put them on the field in the right lane and remove the roadblocks and empower them and see them blossom. So for me at the time, it was, you know, having someone help manage my calendar and a receptionist, because for me to go back five times to try to get, you know, schedule a meeting, and I encourage people to this day, one of the best things and the person that has the most job security in my world is my executive assistant. I can do a whole lot with a good executive assistant.
Yeah.
And years ago, I gave up my entire calendaring and gave it to my executive assistant.
Wow.
So literally, if my phone, and I'm respectful to your gentleman's time here today and you driving all the way up to see me today, but if this popped in and said, I'm supposed to go over to that corner and look 30 degrees west up in the sky, if that's what it says on my phone, because my assistant put it on, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know why I'm looking 30 degrees west or whatever, but my assistant empowers me with my phone. And I think that that's really important. And then the next hire was someone to help with, you know, the financial items, because I was writing checks till midnight at night, you know, and doing all the accounting and those kind of things.
Yeah.
So figure out where your skill set is, hire other people. There's three things that I should be doing for my firm moving forward. That is setting strategy for the firm, because I meet a lot of people, and I was just at lunch with a lender, and then I'll meet with an investor. I get to see hopefully a broader picture. So set the strategy of our firm, of why we're going and where we're going. Number two is to make sure the right people are on the right bus going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And that one's really hard, you know, to make sure those seats are filled. And as I said in my book, sometimes there's someone who shouldn't be on the bus, who's
moving
causing
at the
problems.
Right speed.
Yeah, and you know, it's time to stop and maybe let that person off the bus.
Yeah.
But we've got a great team, and I'm so thankful for them. And then the last thing that I should be doing for my firm is helping to build massive relationships that can really move the needle. After that, my team can rack and stack and execute and just empower them. And it's just such a blessing being an entrepreneur, and it's very humbling to know that I'm responsible helping people meet their mortgage payments or their college debt payments or sending their kids off to college. You know, that's a really humbling and honoring experience when you get to that level.
I think it has to be just so difficult, especially for the amount of dollars that are being traded, you know, in our industry, you know, to be able to empower people to do it, because we see that in so many different companies that we work with, where people see a certain level of success and then they're not willing to delegate, they're not willing to empower people to make decisions, and it hinders a lot of growth. And it has to be hard as a leader, because you know, this is your baby.
I feel sorry for those people in a way, because one, I feel sorry for their people, because they're not letting their people fully blossom and reach their full potential, right? But I also feel sorry for them. I mean, some of the greatest lessons I've learned from people are what I don't want to emulate. And I say in my book, I believe there's two things you can learn from every single human being you meet on this planet, regardless of their station in life. One, what you want to emulate in your own life, what you want to replicate. You say, oh, they're doing this good. They, you know, are a great family person. I want to live a life like that. But the other thing you can learn from them is what you don't want to emulate.
Yeah.
And some of the most successful people I know, it's more of what I don't want to emulate.
Sure.
And that is, they don't have a life. They're running around, you know, they're doing all kinds of stuff, and they're just totally stressed out. And instead saying, you know what, empower your people and encourage them and see them blossom and live the life. Be an architect of your life. Most people are more reactive versus proactive. And I encourage people, you only got one shot at this thing called life. Figure out what you want to do and go chase it down and be an architect and be proactive versus reactive.
Yeah.
Yep.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something that a lot.
And you've done a very good job, obviously, of outsourcing and delegating. And I think that that's one thing I can personally do in my business is really take a closer look at what I am not strong at.
Yeah.
I am more of the relationship builder and not the underwriter.
Yeah.
You know, and I, in my business, you know, with my goals of wanting to raise capital to be a deal sponsor and principal and bring in other GPs on the deal.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's what I need to do is have an analyst and an acquisitions guy.
Yeah. Well, I say that in my book. You know, my father, who I love and respect, you know, in his Century 21 office, my dad was the kind of guy who he had to do it all.
Yeah.
And so he had his marketing signs strewn out all of these houses all around the county and other counties. And he would go around and personally mow all the grass, you know, growing up around these signs. Mm-hmm. And it would take him hours, and he'd come back sweaty and totally tired after being at the office all day. And if my dad would have went out and hired some kid or some individual who wants part-time work for $10-15 an hour and right. done that for him. And he spent his time focusing on one relationship and one sale. That one sale would have more than paid every single mowing yeah. of every single sign that he would have needed for the next 10 years out, right?
And I think you even mentioned Henry Ford's quote.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. And it's this idea, but it, again, you have to be really brutally honest with yourself and have humility and realize that, hey, you know what? This other person may or may not do it better than you, but your job is to come alongside and create that opportunity and figure out where you're going to move the needle the most in your own life.
Yep.
It's vital.
So pivoting a little bit and moving into to more of the real estate side of your business, and this goes all into the entrepreneurial side as well, but you know, we really want to talk about one specific deal that you mentioned in your book as well, and that's, you know, when you purchased the Albertsons boxes.
Uh-huh.
And the reason we're kind of intrigued by that specifically is, again, you were at the time of obviously launching, you know, North Star Commercial Partners, and you're buying, you know, these big vacant boxes, mm-hmm. right? And again, the mindset, we'd really like to hear from you how you and your team are at that time or today, how you guys really look at deals, digest deals, strategize about deals, and ultimately become comfortable enough
yeah.
to say, okay, we're going to pull the trigger on this. Because, yeah. you know, a lot of times in our business, obviously fear, you know, overcomes. And people get talk themselves out of deals all the time. And yeah. at that time, you know, you mentioned it was at the depths of the recession.
Yeah.
You had to pay cash for these assets. They're vacant. I would love to hear some background on that.
Yeah. So the Albertsons transaction actually happened when we were about 10 years into the company. So we founded the company in 2000 is when I started it. And this happened during the Great Recession.
Yeah.
And we come from a little bit of a different mindset as a firm in that we truly believe you make your money on the buy.
Yeah.
A lot of people say it, few people practice it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of liken it to once you set the peg of where your value is, you either are going to benefit from that value ongoing throughout the investment, or you're going to be trying to make up for a bad investment decision. And so we are very different in the marketplace compared to most investors that I know, in that, one, we believe you make your money on the buy. Two, I believe it's less risky to buy a fully vacant building for pennies on the dollar than a fully leased building mm-hmm. where my income stream can get up in the middle of the night and leave me with a high basis.
Yeah.
Most investors, most large institutions, that's counter to them. They want cash flow, they're mm-hmm. underwriting it, etc. For me, I'd rather go buy a building for 10 cents on the dollar because, you know what? I know I can figure it out. If I have a lower basis than my competition, I can be more patient, I can be more creative, I can cut a better deal, a host of other things, staying power, etc. So Albertsons Grocery Stores was here in Colorado. Mm-hmm. They decided to pick up stakes and leave. We were fortunate to go in and buy all their vacant buildings that they had. There was five of them. And we paid about $9.25 a square foot to buy them. But at the time, this was in the down economy. You couldn't go get debt, let alone for retail, let alone sure. for vacant buildings. So we had to pay 100% cash for these. And we ended up selling them for anywhere from $30 to $50 a square foot, which is still a great deal. Replacement mm-hmm. cost value is probably $100.
Right.
And $90 to $100. And we sold them off to the antique dealer, to a college, to all these different people who wanted to have them as a second life. And so if my basis is $9.25 and I'm selling at $30 to $50 a square foot, you can make good money on that.
And there's still enough arbitrage in there for the next guy to
there's
have some meat
for the
on
next
the
guy.
Yeah.
There's enough for the next guy. Yeah. And a big shift for us as a company, you know, I started off buying vacant distressed real estate because I really liked it and wanted to move the needle with it. But for us, a big transformation in my life was this book called Halftime, which I mentioned in my book, which is this Bob Buford book that talks about going from success to significance. And I started to think about it and pray about it and say, you know what, it's got to be more than just making money. And so we put a social impact into our company whereby we're really in the business of creating jobs and opportunity and empowering mm-hmm. people by buying vacant assets in communities and creating those jobs. You know, today on the news, I just heard on NPR this morning that Russell Stover's Candy employs 400 people in my hometown over there in Montrose in the Western mm-hmm. Slope. They just announced Russell Stover's is leaving the manufacturing operation there. And you know, that's 400 jobs out of a community like that.
Yeah.
And could we go 400 families, yeah. you know, and could we go in and have a positive impact in buying something like that and finding out what its next life will be? That's the stuff that makes it more meaningful. And yes, we can make a good return. You know, I really believe you can do well by doing good. And when mm-hmm. I say do well, I mean financially. Yes, you can make a great living, but you can also do good as well and have an impact in people's lives.
That seems to be a common theme in a lot of your philosophy is having that that impact is yeah. what drives you. I mean, money is, you know, is motivating, but at the end of the day, if that's all you're chasing, it can be empty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, my parents told me when I was young, you know, you'll be a blessed man if you could impact one life for the better. And if God gives you the opportunity to impact hundreds or thousands or millions, so be it, but always focus on the one. And so a lot of what we do is about focusing on the one. I'll give you a hard, kind of a touching story. We were buying vacant buildings for schools because I believe that education is one of our civil rights issues in America that we have to get right in our country. Mm-hmm. You know, the wealthy already have choice, mm-hmm. right? They can move to the school district of their choice, or they can afford private schools. Mm-hmm. It's everybody else who's caught in this current system. And I'm a public school kid, and I'm grateful for our public school system, mm-hmm. but I want to make sure kids go to the best school of their choice, whatever that looks like for them. And I have, you know, four kids, and each of them may need different schooling environments than another. So long and the short of it is, we were buying vacant buildings for faith-based and charter-based schools to help them move from that free church basement into a facility. And one of the buildings that we bought was in Gary, Indiana. Gary, Indiana has a 30% unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. You drive into Gary, Indiana, and literally there are buildings that are burnt out and vacant, and they don't even demo them. I mean, mm-hmm. it's unbelievable. So we went in and bought a 43,000 square foot turnkey school building. And you think about what school districts pay on buildings today. It's crazy, the cost that they cost to build. And we ended up buying that building for about $235,000.
Wow.
You spend more than $235,000 paving a parking lot, sure. let alone in the lobby of some yeah. of these schools. So we bought it for $235,000 cash because you can't get financing in a vacant school building in Gary, Indiana. And we ended up finding another school to come back in, and they eventually bought it for us from us for about $500,000, $600,000, something like that. Great deal for them as well. But the neat part of the story is that just before Christmas, we got a call from a gentleman, and his daughter, and let us know he used to be a janitor and went to school in this building and used to as a kid and then was a janitor and lost his job many years ago. And she said, you know what, you brought my dad to tears during Christmas because now he has a job again working in that school building because wow. the new school hired him. Like, you think about the impact of that one person's life, right, of having a job and being able to provide for his family and being there at Christmas, like mm-hmm. that it means more than whether we doubled the price of the building or not to me on an individual basis.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
It's refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many sharks in the water out there. It's great to have, you know, social investors and people that take this into account.
Yeah, but you think about what we can do on this platform of commercial real estate, right? There's creating jobs and opportunity, and then there's the ripple effect. I kind of liken it to the pebble, right, in that calm pond. Until the broker goes out and identifies the deal, or until we buy that building, you may have a still stagnant pond. But all of a sudden, we're that moment in time where this pebble is dropped and the ripple effects happen. So at the closing table now, people are getting paid, you know, the title company, the yeah. attorneys, and then all of a sudden we hire a contractor to come in and paint the building or fix up the parking lot, and now there's another ripple effect in yeah. creating jobs and opportunity mm-hmm. in the local community. And then we get a tenant in there, and then those kids learn, you know, job skills and training, and like this ripple effect that you don't know how far it's going to have the impact.
That's a
great
analogy.
And then in addition, we get to, you know, impact real estate from an environmental perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love going in and identifying a building that has asbestos and, you know, is environmentally a problem in a community and repositioning that. You know, one of the assets we bought was a microchip manufacturing facility. They moved their operations to Asia. And this community reached out to us and said, look, we have this 100,000-foot vacant microchip manufacturing facility. Teenagers are going in and painting pentagrams on the wall and doing not-so-good stuff in this building.
Yeah.
And like it's a blight on our community.
Yeah.
Would you come in and buy it? And so we went in and bought this building, and we worked with the city and built new industrial there. And now new jobs and opportunity are there. So from a job creation perspective, a value creation, environmental impact, I mean, there's a host of things that we have a social role to play versus just going out and making money. We can actually make money and also have this impact on that level. That's one of my topics. I really get excited
about. We love it. Clayton and I are both family men with kids, and it all carries weight with us. And, you know, in that same vein, a lot of coaches and mentors and gurus in the commercial world would say, pick a niche, specialize, stick to it. And for a period of time, that's applicable and relevant. But, at your point in the game where you have evolved, you've got industrial assets and senior living, and you've done stuff, with schools and retail. Is there any particular asset class that you are partial to, or that you're looking at, trends in the future that you really are focused in on right now?
Yeah. So by design, we have gone into different product types. So when I was a broker, I was an office broker, right? Mm-hmm. Cut my teeth there. But then I took lessons in office and I overlaid it to other product types like industrial, et cetera. And so by design as a company, we are in different asset classes, because if one cylinder stops firing, I still want to be firing on other cylinders. So if your thing is development, I'd encourage you to think about, developers can, live and die on an economy, on the tide of the economy. So we buy existing buildings, we do development and different product types. In terms of the product type that will always be near and dear to my heart, it's industrial. Okay. I love industrial, and I love the people that are industrial. This morning I went down and toured this industrial building, and these guys are manufacturing these ice machines. And, some of these people have been on the floor for 40 years.
Hard workers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the backbone of America. Yeah. Yeah. And what I love about industrial is that we're sitting on the 35th floor of our building here right now.
Absolute beautiful view. Well, thank you. This should be on video.
Yeah, we got those mountains there for you. Yeah. But literally everything in this room, from your laptop to the shirt on your back to our glasses on the table, was warehoused sometime, somewhere, by somebody.
Yeah.
Even if that came in from Asia, even if it came in from the U.S. and was manufactured here, it was created. And it's amazing, like when I go through these buildings and see something tangible that somebody does. Mm-hmm. One of our buildings one year that we had, for instance, they were the world's leader in ballet bars, manufacturing ballet bars, like in the studios. I didn't know there was a world leader in ballet bars, right? Another person, they made bowling pins, and it's just fascinating. Another guy, he takes the munitions and everything, the guns from the U.S. military, brings them in Alabama in a facility we have, and breaks them apart and decommissions the guns for the U.S. military. And he also takes the gas masks and everything. Like, it's just cool, stuff that people actually touch. So I would say industrial is always one of my favorite. However, one of our biggest focuses right now is in data centers.
Oh, wow, great.
We are approaching about $1 billion in data center ownership and development, and we're very excited about that space, but still do office, industrial, some retail, senior care, medical, et cetera. So a little bit of a few things.
Well, New Mexico is a huge market for data centers, so we'll continue that conversation offline.
Yeah, it'd be great.
So let's talk about, as far as you approaching a deal.
Yeah.
So two questions that we'd like to get your opinion on, since you've been so successful in your career is, you mention in your book a lot of times on experiencing different cultures and learning different negotiation styles through different cultures. How has meeting and breaking bread with people across different oceans, affected the way that you've built this empire that you have today?
Well, thank you. I appreciate you calling it empire. We just feel blessed and honored to be where we are, and we never take it for granted. But, we do. We have investors from around the world. We also have people that we'll sell to, et cetera. And so, for instance, the Israelis, we have Israeli investment partners. And, their ability to negotiate and the power of no is pretty amazing. I say in my book, we have a Western mindset. And in the Western world, we're always trying to meet in the middle, try to make everybody feel good and come to terms on a deal, right? There's other cultures that just to survive in a desert or in a very hostile environment have to, be concerned about every single precious resource. And so they'll just keep saying no. And in our Western mindset, we think we need to move half closer. And then they say no again, and we move half again. And so, this idea of the power of no, sometimes it's okay to say no. some of the best deals you'll ever do are the ones you don't do.
Sure.
You know, and like I say in my book, one of my wise investors, one of the largest home builders in the world, said to me one time, he said, Brian, what can take you a moment to buy can take you a lifetime to sell. Right.
Yeah.
Just remember that.
Yeah.
So the power of no. I would also say the power of patience. You know, this idea that, you know, it's okay to let things kind of ebb and flow a little bit and to understand it. And then to realize about the essence and surety of cash flow. You know, if you're cashing a check on a deal and you're getting rent, that's okay. You know, the market can come and go and you're going to have staying power. And it's about living sometimes to fight, you know, for another day. And so I just love it, whether it be the Middle East or whether it be Asia. I mean, when I go to Asia, it is, I see why a lot of the, you know, China and everything are growing so well. Their speed to a transaction is unbelievable.
Really?
I mean, you'll be at a table and all of a sudden, within a matter of minutes, I mean, decisions will be made that'll blow your mind.
Sure.
But in other cultures, like in Japan, you know, this idea of shame and honor and everything, sometimes you might not get an answer for a while.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating just to learn from different cultures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of our assets right now are in the U.S., and I love working in the U.S. It will always be our focus, but it's fun learning from others and applying it into what we do.
And what really inspired you to do that? Do you just have a love for the world, basically, for lack of a better term?
No, I appreciate saying that. So, you know, again, I grew up in a family that never traveled, you know, like that. You know, we never went out of the country. We just didn't have that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a student at CU and always wanted to travel. And I saw these little flyers on campus for this thing called Semester at Sea.
Yeah.
This big cruise ship with a few hundred students that floated around the world. Well, I didn't have enough money to go on Semester at Sea. I mean, I was a work-study student shoveling horse stalls at CU Boulder just to put myself through college. And so I said, well, I'll just apply, and maybe they have a work-study, you know, program or something that I can work. So anyway, they hired me, and I put the little newspaper together for the students on the ship. And so I got to go around the world for basically for free.
Yeah.
And I worked my tail off. And, and these kids that I was exposed to, the amount of wealth on that ship was crazy.
Yeah.
And they would go into these countries and buy lavish things or whatever. I had my little backpack and would just go kind of tool around the countryside. And we went to all these amazing countries, and that's what created the travel bug for me.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I love to travel. I love different cultures. I'm married to a Vietnamese woman, and you know, we love going to Asia together and everything. And I love just diversity. Diversity makes us strong.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart in the country today. Thank you so much. It breaks my heart in this country today. You know, what makes America so strong is its diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And we should celebrate that, and we should encourage it. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so special.
And I think it makes you unique as as an investor as well, being able to make that, you know, to reach out to other cultures, understand that culture, bring them into the, you know, American, you know, economy. I mean, there's a lot of power to that.
And there's so much money that wants to get into the United States. You know, we are the largest commercial real estate market in the world.
Yeah.
And when you have the safety and security and opportunity in this country, a lot of money wants to get here. And I think going out and building those relationships with those people. And one thing I really like about it is when you get to the point where an investor takes you into their home and you break bread with their family, like that is an honor in these
really
countries.
Is.
You know, it is in America too, but even more so in these countries.
Yeah.
And when you get to break bread and meet their families and everything, it's just, it's fun to
it's
learn
pretty
from
intimate.
Them. Oh my gosh, amazing.
Do you guys have any aspirations as the company right now to purchase anything outside of the U.S. to the extent you're comfortable and at liberty to share?
Well, historically, we have not, because I have a fiduciary responsibility to my investors to really know the market that I'm in.
Sure.
And I understand the legal system and the business environment in the U.S. And when we are having investors co-invest alongside of us, I need to really make sure that I really understand that. And I don't want to be in cultures where things like property rights are taken for granted.
Yeah.
You know, if you go buy a building in some of these countries and the government comes in and says, you know what, we want that building now, that could be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a shame, you know, because it really hurts their people, you know, as well.
So,
but to answer your question, historically we have not. However, with our data center growth, most likely we will be going into other countries and we will, you know, grow with this data center movement on a global scale. but to be very cautious in terms of which countries that we're in to make sure that they're stable. You know, I've done a lot of studying over it. You can have a pretty mediocre investment in a foreign country, and the exchange rate changes, it can turn it into a phenomenal investment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a really good investment, and the exchange rate changes, and all of a sudden that thing can go in the hole.
Whole different dynamic.
Yeah. And you think about, let's say you're in China right now, as an example, and with the coronavirus and, you know, the rule of law and property rights and everything. I mean, just be careful on what you're doing.
Sure.
But I think it'd be fun and it would be exciting, but I just want to be very, very focused on how we go about it.
So it was interesting because I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you. You know, you obviously own assets in several different states across the entire nation.
Yeah.
How do you get comfortable as an investor and a sponsor on a particular market?
It's a great question. So we enter markets in two primary ways. Number one, we work with corporations. So as a company, we operate in three primary verticals. Vertical number one, buying vacant distressed commercial real estate at 50% or less of replacement cost value, trying to drive a mid-20s or higher net pre-tax IRR to our investors. Vertical two is working with corporations, where we buy or build facilities for them, and we're trying to hit a high teens, low 20s return, still opportunistic level return. And then vertical number three is our value add play, where we're buying that, you know, 70% leased building and trying to, you know, grow its income and hold it for a longer period. When we go into states outside of Colorado, we go in one of two ways. Either A, buying vacant and distressed for pennies on the dollar, and we're so far below market values that we can afford to leave a little bit on the table than maybe the local person can, who's executing and, you know, knowing that market really well, and still do well ourselves. Or we're working with a corporation that's helping to mitigate that risk because they're bringing their tenancy to the table and we're building and owning, you know, a piece of real estate for them.
Yep.
So those are the two primary ways we go into those markets. And then it's always a revolving door where we're buying and selling within those markets.
How, thank you for answering that.
Yeah.
How throughout your career, and I know it's evolved over time, so I'd like to hear from a couple different stages on when you started versus to where you are now. What's been the most effective way for you to procure transactions and identify transactions?
Yeah. So we identify them in a few different ways. First is through our relationships. You know, we're very relational. So if you do research on us, you know, we're involved in everything from philanthropy to politics to business to just trying to be good community citizens. So we get a lot of our deals just from people saying, you know what, I get a choice of who I want to work with. I want to work with someone who actually has a heart, who actually does care about my community, who isn't just worried about the, you know, big green dollar, that actually, you know, does care. So we get a lot of deals from that. The second way we get a lot of deals is working with corporations directly. You know, a lot of corporations in America got rid of their corporate real estate departments years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got a CFO or a general counsel handling their host of duties plus this thing called real estate.
Right.
So we come in and we work with them as a collaborative partner to say, how can we, you know, get rid of that environmentally distressed asset for you, or how can we buy or build this other one, or is there doing M&A transactions, we'll come in, they want OpCo, we want PropCo, we'll come in and monetize the real estate so they can extract the business operations, as an example, and to make sure you're handling it correctly. And I think that's really important. A third way we get deals is through the brokerage community. You know, again, the brokers for us, we do multiple deals with them and been doing it for a very long time. A broker knows they can bring us a deal even if they don't have it under contract. They could even bring us a deal that they're trying to vie for the competition on. We can submit a letter of intent, and that helps to, you know, get them the listing eventually, because they're showing they're already working on it without even having an agreement. You know,
and you'll say, and what you're alluding to is that you'll protect them.
Absolutely.
Brokers bring you a deal, for the long term good of the relationship, you'll take care of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, my word is my bond.
Yeah.
And if I say that we're going to do something, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the way North Star separates itself from a lot of the competition. I can walk into a room, I can sit down with a decision maker, whether a seller, a buyer, a tenant, whatever, broker, and commit to something in that room and walk out, and they know it's as good as being done. Now, we'll paper it up because it's the world we live in, and if one of us gets hit by the proverbial bus, you got to have it. But a lot of other companies, they got to check with New York or Chicago or Beijing or whatever to get the approval to go forward with the deal.
Yeah.
And that's intimidating for some people because they are not willing to be able to make a decision right there and then. But we're able to do that, and that really separates us. And then I would say another way we get a lot of deals, too, is through, you know, business brokers and different things. You know, they might be selling the company, real estate's in tow, et cetera. So we're just very active in the marketplace. And we come from an opportunity-rich mindset. There's always plenty of deals out there. The issue isn't deals. Mm-hmm. The issue is doing the best deals with the right people.
Exactly.
And so for us, you know, we don't have this single slice of pie theory, and I talk about this in my book as well. I think in part of people in society, they believe there's one slice of pie, and everybody's vying for this piece of pie, and if I get a bite of the pie, it means because I gave you an uppercut, and I kicked you in the ankles, and that's the only way I can get a piece of pie, right? And so at North Star, we don't believe in a single slice of pie. We believe we're in the pie-making business. Let's just make more pies.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's more opportunity for everybody, and I think that's a problem for a lot of people in society. So that opportunity-rich mindset, and that also means we're not trying to get rich off of one deal. You know, we've been blessed making money. We want to do great deals with great people.
You know, one aspect, and I want to ask this because I feel like it's important and it's something that's often overlooked in our business, especially with, and I think I'd like you to talk to a lot of the younger people that are getting into the business, is the importance of getting involved on the political side in the business that we're in. I feel like that's something super important. It's becoming more and more important in my business individually. Guide us a little bit on that and tell us a little bit how, you know, your political relationships have, you know, helped foster, you know, your success.
Yeah, well, I didn't come from a political family either. Mm-hmm. And what really got me involved in politics, I was on semester at sea and I was traveling from Brazil to South Africa. And Desmond Tutu, at the time, got on board the ship. And I got to meet him, an amazing, peaceful individual, and talk to him. And I got to South Africa, and I went off into the countryside, and it was beautiful, and we, you know, great wine, all this other stuff. And but we didn't see any black people. And it really hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back into the main city that we were going into, and in Cape Town. And then we were brought into the black townships. And I got to see how a government can control reality.
Interesting.
The black people were in the townships being herded like cattle.
Wow.
And it really hit me deep that our view of the world is partly shaped by who's in power in politics. And the more I studied, the more I realized that, you know, we're all involved in politics whether you want to be or not. The only question is, do you have a say in what's being done? And so that's what started my journey in politics, because I wanted to fight, you know, on behalf of, you know, the everyday person, and to fight for justice and equality. I thought those were absolutely vitally important. And so even today in Colorado, you know, there's a couple of bills right now before where they're thinking about a 1% growth, 1% cap on all growth. It just happened out here in one of our cities in Lakewood. Last year, this individual said, let's cap all growth by 1%.
Wow.
Sounds good if you're tired of traffic, and sounds good if, you know, you don't like, you know, waiting in line for something. But what they don't understand is that that's going to impact prices. People are not going to afford, because no one's going to be able to build out there. So it's simple supply and demand. And now that individual who did that wants to do it on a statewide basis. Compare that to other states who are just dying to have good industries and good quality labor and good values in their local communities. And now Colorado's gotten to this point where they want to do it for the entire state. You know, again, I grew up in a small agricultural community, and what's going on over there is not what's going on in Denver. In fact, I just told you what's going on in Montrose is 400 good jobs are being taken out of the community.
Yeah.
Whereas in Denver, people are trying to cap growth.
Yeah.
And so we decided to get involved in politics and to have a voice in the public square, because otherwise we're all going to be that proverbial frog in the pot of boiling water, where little by little our rights are taken away. Little by little government takes more control. Little by little they keep increasing taxes such that you can't even survive.
Yeah.
And I think we need more good people doing it for the right reasons. And so that's why we've been involved in the public square. I've run for office, and, you know, you take hits for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's unfortunate. And that's why it makes a lot of good people not want to get involved.
Yeah, it's a tough game. And, You've got a lot of exposure there, even if your policies are sound, and it's just a tough business. And we need good leadership in those roles. There's policy in Albuquerque and throughout New Mexico that's been proposed that is not business friendly. Clayton and I have both testified on the legislative floor at the Roundhouse in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. We've talked to the Environmental Planning Commission locally in Albuquerque as recently as last month. In support of business-friendly policy. Mm-hmm. So
it's important.
Yeah,
it's so important.
It's vital.
Yeah.
And again, you know, time and time again in business, I run into people say, well, you know, I'm a business person. I'm not a political person.
Yeah.
And I just ask them a few simple questions.
Yeah.
Do you live? Do you breathe? Do you have kids? Do you have a car? Do you have a house? You're involved. Politics is affecting you every single day, whether you want it to or not. The only question is, are you having any say? And if you decide to leave that field of political ideas and thought and commentary by not testifying, by just focusing on yourself, that vacuum that you leave is going to be gladly filled by others.
Yeah.
And those others may have ideas that are counter to the very way of life that we think is proper in America or in our local communities.
A lot of
and,
momentum out
and
there.
And they want you to leave that field of thought because they want to take and fill those ideas with their own. So I encourage people, you got to be involved, and whether you at least vote, at least be informed, you know, at least support a good candidate. And if you're called for it, go ahead and run yourself.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think it's really important.
So, you know, want to be respectful of your time, obviously. Mm-hmm. And as a closing, you mentioned it earlier that, you know, we should all live a life where we reach a certain level of success and then pivot into significance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would really like to hear from a guy that has accomplished so much. What do you define as success?
That's a great question. So, you know, for me, success would be living a life well lived, and that somehow, some way, when I die, that somebody says, you know what, he impacted me in a positive way. You know, it might have been a building that I bought. It might have been an employee that I helped or whatever it might be. And this idea that, you know, we made a positive impact. My father, I went back to his funeral in upstate New York. And my dad was a man of very humble means. And that little church, you couldn't find a seat to sit in. And there was people all standing around the side. And person after person got up and said, you know what, when I was in the nursing home, he brought me a big bucket of ice cream. You know, when I found out I had cancer, he came over with a homemade pie. Like, it's stuff like that. That's a life well lived, and that's truly success. People are not going to remember what we have or what we don't have in terms of monetary possessions, but they are going to remember, did you touch them on a personal level?
Mm-hmm.
And that's me. I want to make sure I'm always available for friends and creating jobs and opportunity. And, you know, even though the battlefield can be tough, and, you know, that Teddy Roosevelt quote that I have in my book, I want to be on the floor. I want to be on the arena floor.
In the arena, yeah.
And I'm going to be bloody, and I'm going to have my nicks, and I'm going to be, you know, might have a leg chopped off from time to time, but I'm always going to be on the arena floor.
And we'll put these quotes in the show notes. The Henry Ford quote.
Good stuff.
The Teddy Roosevelt. Yeah,
but
love them.
Anybody can sit in the stands and throw insults and be disengaged and complain.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be on the field and trying to make a positive impact, and that's a life well lived, and that's true success for me, and being the father and husband and community leader that I should be.
It's well phenomenal. Said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well
yeah.
said. So, well, you know, again, do you have any other questions you'd like
you
to
know,
ask?
You know, one final question that I'd just like to ask there, you know, is there anything in your personal life, you know, that you've got? I always like to look at the business, the spiritual, the mental side of success. Mm-hmm. Are there any things that you're doing outside of the office and in your physical or spiritual world that you think are helping to create success in the business world?
Yeah, I would say there's probably three primary things.
Okay.
Number one, you know, I'm a person of faith, and you know, when I'm in church on a Sunday morning and hearing a message and to really realize, you know, what it's all about, at least from my personal perspective, you know, I feel humbled. You know, I was created to create and to live and to serve and love on others. And so that inculcates everything that we do as a company. I don't wear my faith on the sleeve, and I'm not trying to push it on anybody, but to be known for my love and my service and to care about others, that's one of my primary drivers.
Absolutely.
I would say number two, you know, being exposed to a diverse community of people and people that don't have a lot. And those are some of the happiest people you'll meet, and it really helps to ground you. You know, I keep a picture here at my office of a little girl playing on the streets in India when I was there. And, you know, I keep that picture in my office, and, you know, she's there almost naked on this little street, and there's all this trash and people getting sick around her. And it reminds me how a good amount of the world lives.
Yeah.
You know, if you're living on a dollar, you know, a day, for instance, and, you know, we'll do negotiations, and at a flip of a wrist, you know, we'll negotiate millions of dollars. And you have to remind yourself, you know, this is a lot of money, and this is, you know, a big stewardship and a big mm-hmm. responsibility. So I would say those. And then I would say the last thing that really impacts me is, you know, spending time in the outdoors. You know, that's why I live in the West. I love it. And whether I have a fly rod in my hand or I'm bow hunting or just going for a hike, to really just realize just what an awesome place we live and how awe-inspiring it is just to be alive. And to realize that, hey, every day that I go into the office and I help to make a new idea or talk to my team and create a new opportunity, it can have a ripple effect that'll long last what we're doing here and how long we're living. So I'd say those three.
Well, we really enjoy your perspective and philosophy.
Thank you.
It's fantastic.
And your willingness to obviously share with us and our audience. So we'll obviously put your contact information in the show notes in the event that anyone wants to reach out to you with a potential deal or a question. And as our listeners have heard several times in this podcast, Brian is the author of two fantastic books. And we'll put the links in the show notes as well. But Gannon and I highly, highly recommend both of them. So
great. I appreciate what you guys are doing. I mean, to share the stories of people, it's a real positive impact that you're having. My throat's dry.
It's all right.
No problem. So thanks again for being here. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey listeners, thanks so much for listening to today's show. Certainly hope that all you have a filled out notepad in front of you with all this just exceptional information that Brian was willing to share with our community. Again, it's not every day you have such a dynamic individual that's willing to share their information, experience, and knowledge with you. So very, very thankful to him. Hope you all got a tremendous amount of value out of this show and really enjoyed it. As always, we will put Brian's information in our show notes if you want to reach out to him with any additional information or questions. And as always, please feel free to share this show with someone that may benefit from it. Other than that, signing off for now.